Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
USDA, no change in the, or excuse me, they did raise the 21 crop average by a nickel, but no change in the crop forecast for the national average cash price. So they're at 595 for the 21 crop average, and that change is really just a reflection of what's already happened. And then their forecast for the 22 crop is still at 675 per bushel. That is not record high. Record high was back in 12 at 689.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue, wondering whether or not we could take out record highs.
I would not be surprised to see us take out that record high. The question, I think, going forward is really what happens this summer, both with respect to the Ukraine situation, but also obviously growing conditions here in the U.S., right?
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We ask people for their thoughts, and so it's an open-ended question where they can share their thoughts, and then we summarize those thoughts into a word cloud, and this does a good job of illustrating the uncertainty that's out there in terms of what the survey respondents are thinking about. We see inputs, regulation, energy, cost, prices, inflation, and so a lot. The real theme here is input costs and the uncertainty related to input costs.
Dr. Michael Lingemeyer with Purdue University on the June Purdue CME Group Ag Economy Barometer.
Looking at the Ag Economy Barometer itself, it dropped 2 points in June from 99 to 97. It's way below what it was earlier this year, and we'll talk more about the reasons why that is the case. Before we do that, let's look at the two sub-indices, the Index of Current Conditions and the Index of Future Expectations. The Index of Current Conditions was up slightly, and the Index of Future Expectations was down slightly. But both of those are at very low levels. In fact, the Index of Future Expectations is at the lowest level it's been since October 2016. And just as importantly, it's lower than what it was in April and May of 2020 when COVID was really hit, and we were really looking at some uncertainty related to crop prices. And so we're at pretty low levels right now compared to where we've been. Let's dig a little deeper into that. One of the questions we ask is this one here. Would you say that your farm operation today is financially better off, worse off, or about the same compared to a year ago? And I've compared June 22 results to June 21 results, and we can see that they're much more pessimistic about the finances today than what they were last year at this time, with 49% saying that their farm is worse off this June compared to last June. If we look at the Farm Capital Investment Index, it remains at 35. It was 35 last month. This is the lowest level during the life of the survey. And essentially what the producers are saying here is this is not necessarily a good time to purchase machinery or buildings. One of the factors that's related to this this index is we've been asking people about the impact of low machinery levels, and 50% of producers in June said purchase plans have been impacted by low machinery levels. Looking at farmland prices, we have two questions on farmland prices, one looking 12 months out and one looking 5 years from now. I'm focusing on the longer-term farmland price expectations. And this month, 57% thought prices are going to be higher 5 years from now. That's down considerably from last fall, when close to 70% thought that farmland prices would be higher 5 years from now. Also, there was a tick up in the percentage that thought we'd have lower farmland prices 5 years from now. And so certainly this is not pessimistic in terms of farmland, but it's less optimistic than what we were last fall and earlier this year. Another question that we asked this month that we asked last year at this time is this question here related to cash rents. Compared to a year ago, what are your expectations for cash rent in your area? Only 3% thought cash rent would be lower in 2023 compared to 2022. And so obviously the strong returns in 21 and expected returns in 22 is putting upward pressure on cash rents. 45% said that cash rent would be about the same, and 52% said cash rent would be higher in 2023 compared to 2022. We also asked a follow-up question of those that indicated that cash rents would be higher. A full 40% of that particular group, which would be 20% of the entire group, thought cash rents would be 10% or more higher in 2023 compared to 2022.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm as big of a fan as anybody else if there's a solution to bring in more water.
Testifying before the Senate Energy Committee recently, John Ensminger, General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
But what we've seen in the last 20 years is really, it's all about conservation. It's all about demand management. And our wake-up call came in 2002, which is still the driest year in the recorded history of the river, when only 25% of normal inflows came in. So beginning in 2002, we upped our Water Smart Landscape program, paying people. We currently pay $3 per square foot for people to remove turf. And as I mentioned in my opening, we've now taken out enough turf in the Las Vegas Valley to lay a 18-inch wide piece of sod all the way around the circumference of the globe. We have very strict water waste enforcement. We have a tiered rate structure so that those who use more water pay more for it and use those funds to fund our conservation programs, and overall, it has led to a dramatic decline in water usage. As I said in my opening, we're using 26% less Colorado River water today than we were in 2002, despite our population increasing by 800,000 people.
He told members of the committee the importance of having a plan and then managing the plan.
We do a 50-year resource plan, and we do it every single year so that we always have a fresh five-decade outlook on what we think our population is going to do, which for Southern Nevada, we project it'll increase from about 2.4 million today to about 3.8 million in 2076. So we are always looking out into the future, and we then match up what we have to accomplish in conservation in order to be able to accommodate that population growth with, again, the smallest water supply on the river. So we are right now using about 112 gallons per person per day, and we project we need to continue to drive down that use to 86 gallons per person per day by 2035 in order to be able to accommodate that growth.
The region that Ensminger deals with is Las Vegas, but he talks about shortage declarations.
Fortunately, because of our conservation efforts, the shortage declaration doesn't mean you have to use less water than you're using today. It reduces your legal entitlement. So we reduced our entitlement from 300,000 to 279,000, but last year we only used 242. So because of two decades worth of preparation, conservation planning, we did not have to actually have our customers reduce the amount of water they used last year.
But finding a solution or just dealing with the issue will take a cooperative and concerted effort.
We need to help all of our friends and partners in the other six states and Mexico continue on their conservation journey. As you know, with the bipartisan infrastructure law, there's funding for the major regional recycling facility in Southern California, and that's an example of across state lines cooperation, and I think a model for other things that need to be done. But every user in every sector needs to be planning for how they're going to take care of their share of the pain.
And one of the biggest issues the West deals with, the effects of evaporation.
It's a huge number. Just between Lake Mead and Lake Powell, you're talking about almost 2 million acre feet of evaporation every year. So to put that in context, they evaporate more just from those two reservoirs than Las Vegas uses in 7 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We've seen ethanol prices remain sideways.
That's Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
That's been the case for the last several years here, last several weeks, excuse me. We still have ethanol priced in Kansas at 255 to 268 as of yesterday, basically June 30th. And that's markedly stronger than where we were basically back around February, March, when we were looking at about $2 a gallon, parts of the country in Iowa and elsewhere, and Kansas as well. So generally, we've had ethanol moving sideways. We've had corn prices now moving a little bit lower. DDG prices have moved lower along with corn, but generally, you look at the type of mathematics that profitability estimates are based on for ethanol plants, and here you have steady ethanol lowering corn input prices. And I think generally profitability off in that sector. You know, a lot of things happening in motor fuel. We had a tax holiday recently, made some difference in prices. They're still above $4 in a good chunk of the country. Still at the Kansas ethanol plants, we're still seeing cash prices on the top end of the range given yesterday was 804 to 805. So we're over $8 for Kansas ethanol plants. And that's, and generally for the major parts of the country of the Kansas that we watch, that'd be the highest price anywhere except in Southwest Kansas, where right around Garden City, about 819. So strong ethanol demand, corn, ethanol plant demand for corn, and really indicative that that industry is continuing to move forward. So while we're talking about that, usage of corn and exports still strong. So I'm an economist. You get me talking on these things. I just talk way too long on all the details of this. Overall, point is that even with high corn prices, our demand has held up decently. And so I think that we're just watching to see how much high prices for grains might choke off usage some. But so far, other than for wheat exports, we still seem to be holding up pretty decently on the usage side.
We talk about uncertainty, USDA facing some of it as well.
Major concerns about what's happening up in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. So the USDA, NAS, National Ag Statistics Service, will go back and reexamine and collect updated information, probably resurvey off in those northern states and see how the numbers could change. And, you know, when you try to look at any one crop that they're measuring, basically they're going to go after them all. You know, there's so much moisture and so much delayed planting that was going on up there that they feel that these numbers aren't the final answer, that there's very likely to be some adjustments that'll happen out in August. So I don't think really the thing that you'd be most wondering about is if it ends up that there's such planting delays on soybeans or late planted corn that it took those numbers down more, particularly if soybeans are taken down more, then that'd be a big issue. And in a year where we're really concerned about what supply demand numbers are in the wheat market, if the spring wheat has also declined precipitously. So if there's a theme that you and I have been seeing here in the last several weeks, it's volatility and uncertainty. And this is only the acreage side. As we referred to earlier, the yield numbers now will come into sharp focus, and we'll see where that would take us. And we're in July, and we have to get through July and August yet to get out into fall, where we start to gain some more confidence in these numbers. And just a lot of moving parts yet in the grain markets.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Looking ahead, what is your biggest concern for farming operation?
Dr. Michael Langemeyer is an ag economist, Purdue University, looking at the June Ag Economy Barometer.
I want to tie this back to the relatively low Ag Economy Barometer Index. I think this chart here explains why the index is relatively low right now. They're very concerned about high input costs. Input costs have increased dramatically in 22, and they're very concerned about that continuing into 2023. The second most common answer was availability of inputs. 21% were very concerned about the availability of inputs. If we'd asked that availability of input question last year, that wouldn't have even been on their radar probably. But given all the concerns we've had in the last few months about availability of herbicide, insecticide, parts, fertilizer to some extent, that is a concern of a lot of producers. Third was lower crop or livestock prices. Again, if we were go back to 2019, for example, I think lower crop or livestock prices would be way up there in terms of a biggest concern, probably over 50%. But these higher input costs and availability of inputs really points to inputs as being on people's minds and really worried about the high input costs we might be seeing next year. To look at that a little closer, we asked this question here. We've been asking this question the last 3 months. Looking ahead to crops that will be planted in 2023, what change do you expect for 2023 crop input prices compared to prices paid for 2022 crop inputs? And remember, we've seen very large increases in 2022. For example, break-even price for corn is up close to 30% in 22 compared to 21. And so this would be input prices above and beyond what we've seen in 2022. You can see that a very small percent think that input prices are actually going to decline. Only 1 out of 10 survey respondents indicated that. Another 25% said, based basically no change. The elevated input prices in 22 are going to remain the same, are going to remain in place. But there was a relatively large percentage of people that thought prices would increase either less than 10%, 10 to 20%, and 20% or more, with 16% in the June survey indicating that they thought input prices would increase 20% or more. And so again, that points back to why the ag economy barometer is relatively low right now. It's this concern for input costs and input prices moving forward. We asked a series of questions related to winter wheat in this survey, just to get some feel for planting intentions related to winter wheat. Winter wheat prices are very high right now, and so we wanted to get a feel for how this might be impacting people's thoughts to what they might do this fall. And so we asked this question of individuals that grew corn, soybeans, wheat, or cotton. And the question is, did you plant winter wheat in the fall of 21? 31% said yes. And then we had a follow-up question for that group. Do you plan to increase your winter wheat acreage in fall 22 compared to fall 21? This question was posed to those who grew winter wheat in 21, so that group that grew winter wheat in 21, and 24% said yes. That might not seem that like a very big percent, but it really is. That would be a rather large increase in winter wheat acreage if those people would produce more winter wheat acres in the fall of 22. And so we're trying to get a feel for the response to the higher wheat prices that we're seeing right now. We also asked a question related to the same issue for people that did not grow winter wheat. And so, do you intend to plant winter wheat in the fall of 22? This is for people who did not grow winter wheat in 21. 14% of those said yes. Again, that's a relatively high percent. If we'd asked this question last year, it wouldn't have been 14%. It would have been something much smaller than that in my mind. And so 14% of those that didn't grow wheat last year are thinking about growing wheat or planting wheat in the fall of 2022. And so, again, a rather big response to the higher wheat prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
What can you tell me about the Bureau's priorities moving forward as they relate to water levels at Lake Powell?
Thank you, Senator, and good morning. We have a great partnership with the state of Utah. Jeanne Shawcroft is one of the principals we work with the basin states.
At a recent Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee hearing, Senator Mike Lee from Utah questioning the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, Camille Tooten.
What we're prioritizing right now is really short term. What actions to make up that 2 to 4 million acre feet in the basin to help protect Lake Mead and Lake Powell? Because all of the actions that you mentioned, the nearly 1 million acre feet that we did this year, buys us a year. And we cannot be in the same place next year where we're talking about critical levels to protect power pool. So we are spending significant amount of time. This is the priority for us between the next 60 days to figure out a plan to close that gap.
Right.
Agriculture seems to be right in the crosshairs. Patrick O'Toole is a Wyoming rancher.
Well, I'm a big fan of data and science, but I will tell you my new friend, Mr. Hall, is in the process of negotiation with the Family Farm Alliance over the open ET issues because of the potential for misuse of the data. And we want data. I want data to do the right thing, but we've got to have some protection because, as you all know, farmers seem to be described as a monolith. We're individual businesses of families mostly, and we can't stand the vulnerability of litigation. I've had it happen to me on a situation where we won finally because the state of Wyoming on bighorn sheep defended us using the Forest Service. But an individual is so vulnerable. And one thing we never talk about, bankers don't care about conservation. They don't care about these issues. They care about getting paid. And when one individual producer sort of gets demonized because of the use of data, we want to make sure that that's done in a way that there's protections for those individual family producers.
Senator Angus King from Maine.
This is a cycle. And I found a very interesting chart that shows the water situation in the West over the last 1,200 years. And what it shows is up and down. And we are at the second lowest point that we've been. The last one was around 1,500. Interestingly, the West was settled and developed during a period of relative high water. And we're now in a situation where we're at this low point. One of the questions is, will the low point, historically these drought periods lasted about 20 years. The question is the climate change effect going to make it a much more permanent kind of situation. Second observation is that the amount of water in the world is constant. It never changes, hasn't changed since the dinosaurs. The question is, where is it? Unfortunately, right now, it's in a lot of places where it doesn't do you any good. In Greenland, I've flown over Greenland in a helicopter and seen the enormous amount of water. In one day last summer, 8 billion tons of Greenland melted. That's enough to cover Florida in 2 inches of water. And the question is, how do we move water? And Senator Lankford asked the interesting question about pipelines. Now, obviously, a pipeline from Greenland isn't possible, but from other sections of the country, I think that's something that needs to be discussed. It's not something we've ever thought about before, but we have pipelines for oil and gas, and we do have, in some areas, huge pipelines for transferring water, for example, in New York State down to the city. Desalinization, we have to talk about. All that water in Greenland is fresh water that's going into the ocean.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Mostly increases across the hard red area, although Texas, you can see actually down 1.8%. Again, a lot of dry conditions all season long in Texas. Kind of a mixed bag as we look across the eastern portion of the growing area. Some states up, some states down.
Lance Honig is the chief of the crops branch for USDA's National Ag Statistics Service.
And again, just a quick look at that change from March. Not a lot of changes here. Again, overall, fairly small change even to the national total since March.
And what about other wheat acres?
11.1 million acres estimated to be planted this season. That's down just 0.8% from the March intentions, 2.7% below what was actually planted last season. Harvested area, 10.7 million acres, up 5.3%, so much higher harvested to planted ratio this year. But if you think back to last season, terribly dry and hot conditions up in the northern portion of the country, really driving abandonment high last year. So this is really much more of a return to a more normal relationship. As you can see on this graph, you can see those two lines converging much more in line with what you would normally expect for this crop.
So we'll jump right into the middle of those hard red winter wheat acres. Dan O'Brien's a K-State grain economist.
The winter wheat numbers came in, winter wheat planted acres of 34.06 are below the bottom end of the pre-report trade estimates for the trade, down 0.7%, 0.7% from figures in the March report. Now, the harvested acres, still pretty optimistic with regard to where harvested acres will be. But, again, harvested acres down about just about 2% from a year ago. So we're full swing in Kansas, if not done harvesting. Now, even out in the Northwest, which is about the last part of the state that's harvested, you're seeing combines moving, still a lot of crops in the field. And you read the same harvest reports out of Kansas wheat that I do, you know, the week daily reports that come out, and a lot of mixed results, some tremendous yields, some very poor yield. In the West, whether wheat was had a longer fallow period in front of it or not made a huge difference. So I think we'll come in next and look and see where the USDA comes in with I think probably, well, there'll be the July report, the August report, but really we hang our hat really on the September annual small grain summary for really figuring out where the markets are at. And with that, you know, the wheat numbers closed on yesterday on the market. Like, we're now looking at the September contract since we're in the delivery period for July or just starting in on it. Closed down to 951, and that's the lowest it's been basically since end of February, early March. So, again, harvest time, still a lot of shortness of wheat in the world. And, you know, we talk about volatility, the measures of momentum in the market, something called relative strength index, down to 42 or 43 out of 100. If it's below 50, it's generally negative. But I guess my own thought is that we're in harvest time. We have wheat that will be moved just because of people, they don't want to pay commercial storage or they lack storage otherwise, you know, on their farms. So I know where we're at right now in the midst of harvest, right after harvest. I really wonder where we'll be on the wheat market in about 4 to 6 weeks once a mini market glut moves its way through.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Back in March, USDA's prospective plantings report shocked the markets by indicating farmers intended to plant more soybeans than corn for only the third time ever.
It looks like that did not happen in reality.
Lance Honig with the USDA Statistics Service says in March, farmers said they intended to plant 89.5 million acres to corn, but in USDA's new acreage report, instead of 89.5 million corn acres,
we're now estimating 89.9 million acres planted for corn. That's up 0.5%, or just 431,000 acres from the March intentions. Still down 3.7% from what was planted last season.
For beans, that March intentions report had producers intending to put in a surprisingly high 91 million acres of soybeans, but looks like actual bean acres,
88.3 million acres estimated to be planted. That's down 2.9% from the March intentions.
And lower than most analysts were projecting, but still 1.3% more bean acres than last year. Gary Crawford, Washington.